friend, was he not?" Young Griff pushed a lock of blue hair out of his eyes. "They were squires together at King's Landing." "A true friend, our Lord Cunnington. He must be, to remain so fiercely loyal to the grandson of the king, who took his lands and titles and sent him into exile. A pity about that. Elsewise, Prince Rhaegar's friend might have been on hand when my father sacked King's Landing, to save Prince Rhaegar's precious little son from getting his royal brains dashed out against a wall." The lad flushed.
"That was not me, I told you. That was some tanner's son from Piswater Bend, whose mother died birthing him. His father sold him to Lord Varys for a jug of Arbor Gold. He had other sons, but had never tasted Arbor Gold. Varys gave the Piswater boy to my lady mother and carried me away."
"Aye," Tyrion moved his elephants. "And when the Piswater prince was safely dead, the eunuch smuggled you across the narrow sea to his fat friend, the cheesemonger, who hid you on a pole boat and found an exiled lord willing to call himself your father. It does make for a splendid story, and the singers will make much of your escape once you take the Iron Throne, assuming that our fair Daenerys takes you for a consort."
"She will, she must."
"Must?" Tyrion made a tisking sound.
"That is not a word queens like to hear. You are a perfect prince, agreed, bright and bold and comely, as any maid could wish. Daenerys Targaryen is no maid, however. She is the widow of a Dothraki Khal, a mother of dragons and sacker of cities, Aegon the Conqueror with teats. She may not prove as willing as you wish."
"She'll be willing." Prince Aegon sounded shocked. It was plain that he had never before considered the possibility that his bride-to-be might refuse him.
"You don't know her."
He picked up his heavy horse and put it down with a thump. The dwarf shrugged.
"I know that she spent her childhood in exile, impoverished, living on dreams and schemes, running from one city to the next, always fearful, never safe, friendless but for a brother who was by all accounts half-mad, a brother who sold her maidenhead to the Dothraki for the promise of an army. I know that somewhere out upon the grass her dragons hatched, and so did she. I know she is proud. How not? What else was left her but pride? I know she is strong. How not? The Dothraki despise weakness. If Daenerys had been weak, she would have perished with Viserys. I know she is fierce. Astapor, Yunkai, and Meereen are proof enough of that. She has crossed the grasslands and the red waste, survived assassins and conspiracies and fell sorceries, grieved for a brother and a husband and a son, trod the cities of the slavers to dust beneath her dainty, sandaled feet. Now how do you suppose this queen will react when you turn up with your begging bowl in hand and say, 'Good morrow to you, auntie. I am your nephew Aegon, returned from the dead. I've been hiding on a pole boat all my life, but now I've washed the blue dye for my hair, and I'd like a dragon, please. And, oh, did I mention, my claim to the Iron Throne is stronger than your own?'"
Aegon's mouth twisted in fury.
"I will not come to my aunt a beggar. I will come to her a kinsman with an army. A small army."
There, that's made him good and angry. The dwarf could not help but think of Joffrey.
"I have a gift for angering princes. Queen Daenerys has a large one, and no thanks to you."
Tyrion moved his crossbows.
"Say what you want. She will be my bride. Lord Cunnington will see to it. I trust him as much as if he were my own blood."
"Perhaps you should be the fool instead of me."
"Trust no one, my prince. Not your chainless maester, not your false father, not the gallant Duck, nor the lovely L'Amour, nor these other fine friends who grew you from a bean. Above all, trust not the cheesemonger, nor the spider, nor this little dragon queen you mean to marry. All that mistrust will sour your stomach and keep you awake by night. 'Tis true, but better that than the long sleep that does not end. The dwarf pushed his black dragon across a range of mountains. But what do I know? Your false father is a great lord, and I am just some twisted little monkey man. Still, I do things differently. That got the boy's attention. How differently? If I were you, I would go west instead of east, land in Dawn and raise my banners. The Seven Kingdoms will never be more ripe for conquest than they are right now. A boy king sits the Iron Throne. The North is in chaos. The Riverlands a devastation. A rebel holds Storm's End and Dragonstone. When winter comes, the realm will starve. And who remains to deal with all of this? Who rules the little king? Who rules the Seven Kingdoms? Why, my own sweet sister. There is no one else. My brother Jamie thirsts for battle, not for power. He's run from every chance he's had to rule. My uncle Kevin would make a passably good regent if someone pressed the duty on him, but he will never reach for it. The guard shaped him to be a follower, not a leader. Well, the guards are my lord father. Mace Tyrell would grasp the scepter gladly, but mine own kin are not like to step aside and give it to him. And everyone hates Stannis. Who does that leave? Why, only Cersei. Westeros is torn and bleeding, and I do not doubt that even now my sweet sister is binding up the wounds with salt. Cersei is as gentle as King Maegor, as selfless as Aegon the Unworthy, as wise as Mad Ares. She never forgets a slight, real or imagined. She takes caution for cowardice and dissent for defiance. And she is greedy, greedy for power, for honor, for love. Tommen's rule is bolstered by all of the alliances that my lord father built so carefully, but soon enough she will destroy them, every one. Land and raise your banners, and men will flock to your cause, lords great and small folk too. But do not wait too long, my prince. The moment will not last. The tide that lifts you now will soon recede. Be certain you reach Westeros before my sister falls, and someone more competent takes her place. But, Prince Aegon said, without Daenerys and her dragons, how could we hope to win? You do not need to win, Tyrion told him. All you need to do is raise your banners, rally your supporters, and hold until Daenerys arrives to join her strength to yours. You said she might not have me. Perhaps I overstated. She may take pity on you when you come begging for her hand. The dwarf shrugged. Do you want to wager your throne upon a woman's whim? Go to Westeros, though. Ah, then you are a rebel, not a beggar. Bold, reckless, a true scion of House Targaryen. Walking in the footsteps of Aegon the Conqueror, a dragon. I told you I know our little queen. Let her hear that her brother Rhaegar's murdered son is still alive. That this brave boy has raised the dragon standard of her forebears in Westeros once more. That he is fighting a desperate war to avenge his father and reclaim the Iron Throne for House Targaryen, hard-pressed on every side. And she will fly to your side as fast as wind and water can carry her. You are the last of her line, and this mother of dragons, this breaker of chains, is above all a rescuer. The girl who drown the slaver cities in blood, rather than leave strangers to their chains, can scarcely abandon her own brother's son in his hour of peril. And when she reaches Westeros, and meets you for the first time, you will meet as equals, man and woman, not queen and supplicant. How can she help but love you, then? I ask you. Smiling, he seized his dragon, flew it across the board. I hope your grace will pardon me. Your king is trapped. Death in four. The prince stared at the playing board. My dragon is too far away to save you. You should have moved her to the center of the battle. But you said I lied. Trust no one, and keep your dragon close. Young Griff jerked to his feet and kicked over the board. Saivas pieces flew in all directions, bouncing and rolling across the deck of the Shy Maid. "Pick those up," the boy commanded. "He may well be a Targaryen after all." "If it please your grace." Tyrion got down on his hands and knees and began to crawl about the deck, gathering up pieces. It was close to dusk when Yandri and Issylla returned to the Shy Maid. A porter trotted at their heels, pushing a wheelbarrow heaped high with provisions. Salt and flour, fresh churned butter, slabs of bacon wrapped in linen, sacks of oranges, apples, and pears. Yandri had a wine cask on one shoulder, while Ysylla had slung a pike over hers. The fish was as large as Tyrion. When she saw the dwarf standing at the end of the gangplank, Ysylla stopped so suddenly that Yandri blundered into her, and the pike almost slid off her back into the river. Duck helped her rescue it. Ysylla glared at Tyrion and made a peculiar stabbing gesture with three of her fingers. A sign to ward off evil. "Let me help you with that fish," he said to Duck. "No," Ysylla snapped. "Stay away. Touch no food besides the food you eat yourself." The dwarf raised both hands. "As you command." Yandri thumped the wine cask down onto the deck. "Where's Griff?" he demanded of Holden. "Asleep." "Then rouse him. We have tidings he'd best hear. The queen's name is on every tongue in Solaris. They say she still sits in Meereen, sore beset. If the talk in the markets can be believed, old Valantis will soon join the war against her." Holden pursed his lips. "The gossip of fishmongers is not to be relied on. Still, I suppose Griff will want to hear. You know how he is." The half-maester went below. The girl never started for the West. No doubt she had good reasons. Between Meereen and Valantis lay 500 leagues of deserts, mountains, swamps, and ruins, plus Mantares with its sinister repute. A city of monsters, they say. But if she marches overland, where else is she to turn for food and water? The sea would be swifter, but if she does not have the ships... By the time Griff appeared on deck, the pike was spitting and sizzling over the brazier, whilst Ysylla hovered over it with a lemon squeezing. The sellsword wore his mail and wolfskin cloak, soft leather gloves, dark woolen breeches. If he was surprised to see Tyrion awake, he gave no sign beyond his customary scowl. He took Yandri back to the tiller, where they spoke in low voices, too quietly for the dwarf to hear. Finally, Griff beckoned to Holden. "We need to know the truth of these rumors. Go ashore and learn what you can. Caver will know, if you can find him. Try the Riverman and the Painted Turtle. You know his other places." "Aye, I'll take the dwarf as well. 4 ears hear more than 2. And you know how Cavo is about his Saivas." "As you wish. Be back before the sun comes up. If for any reason you're delayed, make your way to the Golden Company." "Spoken like a lord," Tyrion kept the thought to himself. Holden donned a hooded cloak, and Tyrion shed his homemade motley for something drab and grey. Griff allowed them each a purse of silver from Illyrio's chest. "To loosen tongues." Dusk was giving way to darkness as they made their way along the riverfront.
Some of the ships they passed appeared deserted, their gangplanks drawn up. Others crawled with armed men, who eyed them with suspicion. Under the town walls, parchment lanterns had been lit above the stalls, throwing pools of coloured light upon the cobbled path. Tyrion watched as Holden's face turned green, then red, then purple. Under the cacophony of foreign tongues, he heard queer music playing from somewhere up ahead, a thin, high fluting, accompanied by drums. A dog was barking, too, behind them. And the whores were out. River or sea, a port was a port. And wherever you found sailors, you'd find whores.
"Is that what my father meant? Is that where whores go, to the sea?"
The whores of Lannisport and King's Landing were free women. Their sisters of Selhoris were slaves, their bondage indicated by the tears tattooed beneath their right eyes.
"Old as sin, and twice as ugly, the lot of 'em."
It was almost enough to put a man off whoring. Tyrion felt their eyes upon them as he waddled by, and heard them whispering to one another and giggling behind their hands. You would think they'd never seen a dwarf before. A squad of Volantine spearmen stood guard at the river gate. Torchlight gleamed off the steel claws that jutted from their gauntlets. Their helms were tiger's masks, the faces beneath marked by green stripes tattooed across both cheeks. The slave soldiers of Valentus were fiercely proud of their tiger stripes, Tyrion knew.
Do they yearn for freedom? He wondered. What would they do if this child queen bestowed it on them? What are they, if not tigers? What am I, if not a lion?
One of the tigers spied the dwarf and said something that made the others laugh. As they reached the gate, he pulled off his clawed gauntlet and the sweaty glove beneath, locked one arm around the dwarf's neck, and roughly rubbed his head. Tyrion was too startled to resist. It was all over in a heartbeat.
"Was there some reason for that?" he demanded of the half-maester.
"He says that it is good luck to rub the head of a dwarf," Holden said, after an exchange with a guard in his own tongue. Tyrion forced himself to smile at the man.
"Tell him that it is even better luck to suck on a dwarf's cock."
"Best not. Tigers have been known to have sharp teeth." A different guard motioned them through the gate, waving a torch at them impatiently. Holden Halfmaester led the way into Selhoris proper, with Tyrion waddling warily at his heels. A great square opened up before them. Even at this hour it was crowded and noisy and ablaze with light. Lanterns swung from iron chains above the doors of inns and pleasure houses, but within the gates they were made of coloured glass, not parchment. To their right, a night fire burned outside a temple of red stone. A priest in scarlet robes stood on the temple balcony, haranguing the small crowd that had gathered around the flames. Elsewhere, travellers sat playing saivas in front of an inn. Drunken soldiers wandered in and out of what was obviously a brothel. A woman beat a mule outside a stable. A two-wheeled cart went rumbling past them, pulled by a white dwarf elephant.
"This is another world," thought Tyrion, "but not so different from the world I know."
The square was dominated by a white marble statue of a headless man in impossibly ornate armor, astride a warhorse, similarly arrayed.
"Who might that be?"
wondered Tyrion.
"Triarch Horondo, a Volantine hero from the Century of Blood. He was returned as Triarch every year for 40 years, until he wearied of elections and declared himself Triarch for life.
The Volantines were not amused. He was put to death soon after, tied between two elephants and torn in half.
His statue seems to lack a head.
He was a tiger. When the elephants came to power, their followers went on a rampage, knocking the heads from the statues of those they blamed for all the wars and deaths. He shrugged. That was another age. Come, we'd best hear what that priest is going on about. I swear I heard the name Daenerys. Across the square, they joined the growing throng outside the Red Temple. With the locals towering above him on every hand, the little man found it hard to see much beyond their asses. He could hear most every word the priest was saying, but that was not to say he understood them. "Do you understand what he is saying?" he asked Holden in the common tongue. "I would, if I did not have a dwarf piping my ear." "I do not pipe." Tyrion crossed his arms and looked behind him, studying the faces of the men and women who had stopped to listen. Everywhere he turned, he saw tattoos. Slaves! 4 of every 5 of them are slaves. "The priest is calling on the Volantines to go to war," the half-maester told him. "But on the side of right, as soldiers of the Lord of Light, R'hllor, who made the sun and stars and fights eternally against the darkness. Nisus and Malachor have turned away from the light," he says, "their hearts darkened by the yellow harpies from the east." He says, "Dragons?" I understood that word. He said, "Dragons." "Aye, the dragons have come to carry her to glory." "Her? Daenerys?" Holden nodded. "Benero has sent forth a word from Volantis. Her coming is the fulfillment of an ancient prophecy. From smoke and salt was she born to make the world anew. She is Azor Ahai, returned, and her triumph over darkness will bring a summer that will never end. Death itself will bend its knee, and all those who die fighting in her cause shall be reborn." "Do I have to be reborn in this same body?" asked Tyrion. The crowd was growing thicker. He could feel them pressing in around them. "Who is Benero?" Holden raised an eyebrow. "High priest of the Red Temple in Volantis. Flame of truth, light of wisdom, first servant of Lord of Light, slave of R'hllor." The only Red Priest Tyrion had ever known was Thoris of Myr, the portly, genial, wine-stained roisterer who had loitered about Robert's court, swilling the king's finest vintages and setting his sword on fire for Meles. "Give me priests who are fat and corrupt and cynical," he told Holden. "The sort who like to sit on soft satin cushions, nibble sweetmeats, and diddle little boys. It's the ones who believe in gods who make the trouble." "It may be that we can use this trouble to our advantage. I know where we may find answers." Holden led them past the headless hero to where a big stone inn fronted on the square. The ridged shell of some immense turtle hung above its door, painted in garish colors. Inside, 100 dim red candles burned like distant stars. The air was fragrant with the smell of roasted meat and spices, and a slave girl with a turtle on one cheek was pouring pale green wine. Holden paused in the doorway. "There, those two." In the alcove, 2 men sat over a carved stone Sivas table, squinting at their pieces by the light of a red candle. One was gaunt and sallow, with thinning black hair and a blade of a nose. The other was wide of shoulder and round of belly, with corkscrew ringlets tumbling past his collar. Neither deigned to look up from their game, until Holden drew a chair between them and said, "My dwarf plays better Sivas than both of you combined." The bigger man raised his eyes to gaze at the intruders in distaste, and said something in the tongue of old Volantis, too fast for Tyrion to hope to follow. The thinner one leaned back in his chair. "Is he for sale?" he asked, in the common tongue of Westeros. "The Triarch's grotesquerie is in need of a Sivas-playing dwarf." "Yellow is no slave." "What a pity!" The thin man shifted an onyx elephant. Across the Saivas table, the man behind the alabaster army pursed his lips in disapproval. He moved his heavy horse.
"A blunder," said Tyrion. "He had as well play his part."
"Just so," the thin man said. He answered with his own heavy horse. A flurry of quick moves followed, until finally the thin man smiled and said, "Death, my friend." The big man glowered at the board, then rose and growled something in his own tongue. His opponent laughed. "Come now, the dwarf does not stink as bad as that." He beckoned Tyrion toward the empty chair. "Up with you, little man. Put your silver on the table, and we will see how well you play the game."
"Which game?" Tyrion might have asked.
He climbed onto the chair. "I play better with a full belly and a cup of wine to hand." The thin man turned obligingly and called for the slave girl to fetch some food and drink. Holden said, "The noble Cavo Nagaris is the customs officer here in Solaris. I've never once defeated him at Saivas."
Tyrion understood. "Perhaps I will be more fortunate."
He opened his purse and stacked silver coins beside the board, one atop another until finally Cavo smiled. As each of them was setting up his pieces behind the Saivas screen, Holden said, "What news from Don River? Will it be war?" Cavo shrugged. "The Yunkai would have it so. They style themselves the wise masters. Of their wisdom I cannot speak, but they do not lack for cunning. Their envoy came to us with chests of gold and gems and 200 slaves, nubile girls and smooth-skinned boys, trained in the way of the seven sires. I am told his feasts are memorable and his bribes lavish."
"The Yunkish men have bought your triarchs?"
"Only Nisus."
Cavo removed the screen and studied the placement of Tyrion's army.
"Malachor may be old and toothless, but he's a tiger still, and Doniphus will not be returned as triarch. The city thirsts for war."
"Why?" wondered Tyrion. "Meereen is long leagues across the sea. How has this sweet child queen offended old Volantis?"
"Sweet?" Cavo laughed. "If even half the stories coming back from Slaver's Bay are true, this child is a monster. They say that she is bloodthirsty, that those who speak against her are impaled on spikes to die lingering deaths. They say she is a sorceress who feeds her dragons on the flesh of newborn babes, an oathbreaker who mocks the gods, breaks truces, threatens envoys, and turns on those who have served her loyally. They say her lust cannot be sated, that she mates with men, women, eunuchs, even dogs and children, and woe betide the lover who fails to satisfy her. She gives her body to men to take their souls in thrall."
"Oh, good," thought Tyrion. "If she gives her body to me, she is welcome to my soul, small and stunted though it is."
"They say," said Holden. "By they you mean the slavers, the exiles she drove from Astapor and Meereen."
"Mere calumnies."
"The best calumnies are spiced with truth," suggested Cabo. "But the girl's true sin cannot be denied. This arrogant child has taken it upon herself to smash the slave trade. But that traffic was never confined to Slaver's Bay. It was part of the sea of trade that spanned the world, and the Dragon Queen has clouded the water. Behind the black wall, lords of ancient blood sleep poorly, listening as their kitchen slaves sharpen their long knives. Slaves grow our food, clean our streets, teach our young. They guard our walls, row our galleys, fight our battles. And now, when they look east, they see this young queen shining from afar, this breaker of chains. The old blood cannot suffer that. Poor men hate her, too. Even the vilest beggar stands higher than a slave. This dragon queen would rob him of that consolation." Tyrion advanced his spearmen. Cavo replied with his light horse. Tyrion moved his crossbowmen up a square and said,
The Red Priest outside seems to think Volantis should fight for the Silver Queen, not against her. The Red Priest would be wise to hold their tongues, said Kaevo Nagaris. Already there's been fighting between their followers and those who worship other gods. Benero's rantings will only serve to bring a savage wrath down upon his head. What rantings? The dwarf asked, toying with his rabble. The Volantine waved a hand. In Volantis, thousands of slaves and freedmen crowd Temple Plaza every night to hear Benero shriek of bleeding stars and a sword of fire that will cleanse the world. He has been preaching that Volantis will surely burn if the Triarchs take up arms against the Silver Queen. That's a prophecy even I could make. Ah, supper! Supper was a plate of roasted goat served on a bed of sliced onions. The meat was spiced and fragrant, charred outside and red and juicy within. Tyrion plucked at a piece. It was so hot it burned his fingers, but so good he could not help but reach for another chunk. He washed it down with a pale green Volantine liquor, the closest thing he'd had to wine for ages. "Very good," he said, plucking up his dragon. "The most powerful piece in the game," he announced, as he removed one of Kaevo's elephants. "Andaerys Targaryen has 3," it said. 3, Kaevo allowed, "against thrice 3,000 enemies?" Grazdan Moiraz was not the only envoy sent out from the Yellow City. When the Wise Masters move against Meereen, the legions of new Gis will fight beside them, Tolossi, Illyrians, even the Dothraki.
You have Dothraki outside your own gates, Holden said.
Carl Pono. Kaevo waved a pale hand in dismissal. The horse lords come, we give them gifts, the horse lords go. He moved his catapult again, closed his hand around Tyrion's alabaster dragon, removed it from the board. The rest was slaughter, though the dwarf held on another dozen moves. "The time has come for bitter tears," Kaevo said at last, scooping up the pile of silver. "Another game?"
"No need," said Holden. "My dwarf has had his lesson in humility. I think it's best we get back to our boat."
Outside in the square, the night fire was still burning, but the priest was gone, and the crowd was long dispersed. The glow of candles glimmered from the windows of the brothel. From inside came the sound of women's laughter. "The night is still young," said Tyrion. "Kaevo may not have told us everything, and whores hear much and more from the men they service."
"You need a woman so badly, Yellow?"
"A man grows weary of having no lovers but his fingers."
"Solores may be where oars go. Tysha might be in there even now, with tears tattooed upon her cheek."
"I almost drowned. A man needs a woman after that. Besides, I need to make sure my prick hasn't turned to stone." The half-maester laughed. "I will wait for you in the tavern by the gate. Do not be too long about your business."
"Oh, have no fear on that count. Most women prefer to be done with me as quickly as they can."
The brothel was a modest one, compared to those the dwarf had been wont to frequent in Lannisport and King's Landing. The proprietor did not seem to speak any tongue but that of Volantis, but he understood the clank of silver well enough, and led Tyrion through an archway into a long room that smelled of incense, where 4 bored slave girls were lounging about in various states of undress. 2 had seen at least 40 name days come and go, he guessed. The youngest was perhaps 15 or 16. None was as hideous as the horse he'd seen working the docks, though they fell well short of beauty. 1 was plainly pregnant. 1 was just fat and sported iron rings in both her nipples. 4 had tears tattooed beneath 1 eye.
"Do you have a girl who speaks the tongue of Westeros?" asked Tyrion.
The proprietor squinted, uncomprehending, so he repeated the question in High Valyrian. This time the man seemed to grasp a word or two, and replied in Volantine. "Sunset girl" was all the dwarf could get out of his answer. He took that to mean a girl from the Sunset Kingdoms. There was only one such in the house, and she was not Taisha. She had freckled cheeks and tight red curls upon her head, which gave promise of freckled breasts and red hair between her legs. "She'll do," said Tyrion, "and I'll have a flagon too, red wine with red flesh." The whore was looking at his noseless face, with revulsion in her eyes. "Do I offend you, sweetling? I am an offensive creature, as my father would be glad to tell you, if he were not dead and rutting." Though she did look Westerosi, the girl spoke not a word of the common tongue. Perhaps she was captured by some slaver as a child. Her bedchamber was small, but there was a mirrorish carpet on the floor, and a mattress stuffed with feathers in place of straw. "Oh, I've seen worse." "Will you give me your name?" he asked, as he took a cup of wine from her. "No." The wine was strong and sour, and required no translation. "I suppose I shall settle for your cunt." He wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. "Have you ever bedded a monster before? Now's as good a time as any. Out of your clothes, and onto your back, if it please you, or not." She looked at him uncomprehending, until he took the flagon from her hands and lifted her skirts up over her head. After that, she understood what was required of her, though she did not prove the liveliest of partners. Tyrion had been so long without a woman that he spent himself inside her on the third thrust. He rolled off, feeling more ashamed than sated. "This was a mistake. What a wretched creature I've become." "Do you know a woman by the name of Taisha?" he asked, as he watched his seed dribble out of her onto the bed. The whore did not respond. "Do you know where whores go?" She did not answer that one either. Her back was crisscrossed by ridges of scar tissue. "This girl is as good as dead. I've just fucked a corpse. Even her eyes look dead. She does not even have the strength to loathe me." He needed wine, a lot of wine. He seized the flagon with both hands and raised it to his lips. The wine ran red down his throat, down his chin. It dripped from his beard and soaked the feather bed. In the candlelight, it looked as dark as the wine that had poisoned Joffrey. When he was done, he tossed the empty flagon aside and half rolled and half staggered to the floor, groping for a chamber pot. There was none to be found. His stomach heaved, and he found himself on his knees, retching on the carpet, that wonderful thick mirrorish carpet, as comforting as lies. The whore cried out in distress. "They will blame her for this," he realized, ashamed. "Cut off my head and take it to King's Landing," Tyrion urged her. "My sister will make a lady of you, and no one will ever whip you again." She did not understand that either, so he shoved her legs apart, crawled between them, and took her once more. That much she could comprehend, at least. Afterward the wine was done, and so was he, so he wadded up the girl's clothing and tossed it at the door. She took the hint and fled, leaving him alone in the darkness, sinking deeper into his feather bed. "I am stinking drunk." He dared not close his eyes for fear of sleep. Beyond the veil of dream, the sorrows were waiting for him. Stone steps ascending endlessly, steep and slick and treacherous, and somewhere at the top the Shrouded Lord. "I do not want to meet the Shrouded Lord." Tyrion fumbled back into his clothes again and groped his way to the stair. "Griff will flay me. Well, why not? If ever a dwarf deserved a skinning, I'm him." Halfway down the steps, he lost his footing. Somehow he managed to break his tumble with his hands and turn it into a clumsy, thumping cartwheel. The whores in the room below looked up in astonishment when he landed at the foot of the steps. Tyrion rolled onto his feet and gave them a bow. "I'm more agile when I'm drunk.
He turned to the proprietor. "I fear I ruined your carpet. The girl's not to blame. Let me pay." He pulled out a fistful of coins and tossed them at the man.
"Imp!" a deep voice said behind him.
In the corner of the room, a man sat in a pool of shadow, with a whore squirming on his lap.
"Oh, I never saw that girl. If I had, I would have taken her upstairs instead of Freckles.
She was younger than the others, slim and pretty, with long silvery hair. Lysenny, at a guess. But the man whose lap she filled was from the Seven Kingdoms, burly and broad-shouldered, 40 if he was a day, and maybe older. Half his head was bald, but coarse stubble covered his cheeks and chin, and hair grew thickly down his arms, sprouting even from his knuckles. Tyrion did not like the look of him. He liked the big black bear in his surcoat even less.
"Wool? He's wearing wool. In this heat? Who else but a knight would be so fucking mad?
How pleasant to hear the common tongue so far from home," he made himself say.
"But I fear you have mistaken me. My name is Hugo Hill. May I buy you a cup of wine, my friend?"
"I've drunk enough."
The knight shoved his whore aside and got to his feet. His sword belt hung on a peg beside him. He took it down and drew his blade. Steel whispered against leather. The whores were watching avidly, candlelight shining in their eyes. The proprietor had vanished.
"You're mine, Hugo."
Tyrion could no more outrun him than outfight him. Drunk as he was, he could not even hope to outwit him. He spread his hands. "And what do you mean to do with me?"
"Deliver you," the knight said, "to the queen."
Daenerys. Galaza Galare arrived at the Great Pyramid, attended by a dozen white graces, girls of noble birth, who were still too young to have served their year in the temple's pleasure gardens. They made for a pretty portrait, the proud old woman, all in green, surrounded by the little girls robed and veiled in white, armored in their innocence. The queen welcomed them warmly, then summoned Missandei to see that the girls were fed and entertained, while she shared a private supper with the Green Grace. Her cooks had prepared them a magnificent meal of honeyed lamb, fragrant with crushed mint, and served with the small green figs she liked so much. Two of Danny's favorite hostages served the food and kept the cups filled. A doe-eyed little girl called Keza and a skinny boy named Graza. They were brother and sister and cousins of the Green Grace, who greeted them with kisses when she swept in, and asked them if they had been good.
"They are very sweet, the both of them," Danny assured her. "Kazar sings for me sometimes. She has a lovely voice. And Sir Barristan has been instructing Grazar and the other boys in the ways of Western chivalry."
"They are of my blood," the Green Grace said, as Kazar filled her cup with a dark red wine. "It is good to know they have pleased your radiance. I hope I may do likewise." The old woman's hair was white, and her skin was parchment thin. But the years had not dimmed her eyes. They were as green as her robes, sad eyes, full of wisdom.
"If you will forgive my saying so, your radiance looks weary. Are you sleeping?"
It was all Danny could do not to laugh.
"Not well. Last night, 3 Carthine galleys sailed up the Skahazadan under the cover of darkness. The mother's men loosed flights of fire arrows at their sails and flung pots of burning pitch onto their decks. But the galleys slipped by quickly and suffered no lasting harm. The Carthine mean to close the river to us, as they have closed the bay, and they are no longer alone. 3 galleys from New Gis have joined them, and a carrack out of Tolos."
The Tolossi had replied to her request for an alliance by proclaiming her a whore and demanding that she return Meereen to its great masters.
Even that was preferable to the answer of Mantares, which came by way of caravan in a cedar chest. Inside she had found the heads of her three envoys, pickled.
"Perhaps your gods can help us. Ask them to send a gale and sweep the galleys from the bay."
"I shall pray and make sacrifice. Mayhaps the gods of Gis will hear me."
Galarza Galari sipped her wine, but her eyes did not leave Danny. Storms rage within the walls as well as without. More freedmen died last night, or so I have been told.
Three.
Saying it left a bitter taste in her mouth. The cowards broke in on some weavers, freed women, who had done no harm to anyone. All they did was make beautiful things. I have a tapestry they gave me hanging over my bed. The sons of the harpy broke their loom and raped them before slitting their throats.
This we have heard, and yet your radiance has found the courage to answer butchery with mercy. You have not harmed any of the noble children you hold as hostage.
Not as yet, no. Danny had grown fond of her young charges. Some were shy and some were bold, some sweet and some sullen, but all were innocent.
"If I kill my cupbearers, who will pour my wine and serve my supper?"
she said, trying to make light of it. The priestess did not smile.
"The shave pate would feed them to your dragons," it is said. "A life for a life. For every brazen beast cut down, he would have a child die."
Danny pushed her food about her plate. She dare not glance over to where Graza and Kezar stood, for fear that she might cry.
"The shave pate has a harder heart than mine."
They had fought about the hostages half a dozen times.
"The sons of the Arpi are laughing in their pyramids," Scar said just this morning. "What good are hostages if you will not take their heads?"
In his eyes she was only a weak woman.
Hazair was enough. What good is peace if it must be purchased with the blood of little children?
"These murders are not their doing," Danny told the Green Greys feebly. "I am no butcher queen."
"And for that, Marine gives thanks," said Galarza Galari. "We have heard that the butcher king of Astapor is dead, slain by his own soldiers when he commanded them to march out and attack the Yunkai."
The words were bitter in her mouth.
"He was hardly cold before another took his place, calling himself Cleon the Second. That one lasted 8 days before his throat was opened. Then his killer claimed the crown. So did the first Cleon's concubine, King Cutthroat and Queen Whore, the Astapori call them. Their followers are fighting battles in the streets, while the Yunkai and their sellswords wait outside the walls. These are grievous times. Your radiance, might I presume to offer you my counsel? You know how much I value your wisdom. Then heed me now, and marry."
"Ah," Danny had been expecting this.
"Ofttimes I have heard you say that you are only a young girl. To look at you, you still seem half a child, too young and frail to face such trials by yourself. You need a king beside you to help you bear these burdens."
Danny spared a chunk of lamb, took a bite from it, chewed slowly.
"Tell me, can this king puff his cheeks up and blow Zaro's galleys back to Karth? Can he clap his hands and break the siege of Astapor? Can he put food in the bellies of my children and bring peace back to my streets?" "Can you?"
the Green Grace asked.
"A king is not a god, but there is still much that a strong man might do. When my people look at you, they see a conqueror from across the seas, come to murder us and make slaves of our children. A king could change that. A high-born king of pure Gascari blood could reconcile the city to your rule. Elsewise, I fear, your reign must end as it began, in blood and fire."
Danny pushed her food about her plate.
"And who were the gods of Gis? Have me take as my king and consort?"
"His Tsar's Olorek," Galaza Galare said firmly. Danny did not trouble to feign surprise. "Why his Tsar? Skahars is noble-born as well."
"Skahars is Kandak, his Tsar Lorek.
Your radiance will forgive me, but only one who is not herself, Giscari, would not understand the difference. Oft have I heard that yours is the blood of Aegon the Conqueror, Jaehaerys the Wise, and Daeron the Dragon.
The noble Hisdar is the blood of Mazdan the Magnificent, Hazrak the Handsome, and Zarak the Liberator. His forebears are as dead as mine. Will Hisdar raise their shades to defend Meereen against its enemies? I need a man with ships and swords. You offer me ancestors.
We are an old people. Ancestors are important to us. Wed Hisdar Zolorek and make a son with him, a son whose father is the harpy, whose mother is the dragon. In him the prophecies shall be fulfilled, and your enemies will melt away like snow.
He shall be the stallion that mounts the world.
Danny Newhart went with prophecies. They were made of words, and words were wind. There would be no son for Lorek, no heir to unite dragon and harpy.
When the sun rises in the west and sets in the east, when the seas go dry and mountains blow in the wind like leaves.
Only then would her womb quicken once again. But Daenerys Targaryen had other children, tens of thousands who had hailed her as their mother when she broke their chains. She thought of Stalwart Shield, of Missandei's brother, of the woman Rhylona Rhee, who had played the harp so beautifully. No marriage could ever bring them back to life. But if her husband could help end the slaughter, then she owed it to her dead to marry. If I wed Hisdar, will that turn Skahars against me? She trusted Skahars more than she trusted Hisdar, but the shavepate would be a disaster as a king. He was too quick to anger, too slow to forgive. She saw no gain in wedding a man as hated as herself. Hisdar was well respected, so far as she could see.
"What does my prospective husband think of this?" she asked the Green Grace. "What does he think of me?"
"Your Grace need only ask him. The noble Hisdar awaits below. Send down to him, if that is your pleasure."
"You presume too much, priestess," the queen thought, but she swallowed her anger and made herself smile. "Why not?"
She sent for Sir Barristan and told the old knight to bring Hisdar to her.
"It is a long climb. Have the Unsullied help him up."
By the time the nobleman had made the ascent, the Green Grace had finished eating.
"If it please your magnificence, I will take my leave. You and the noble Hisdar will have many things to discuss, I do not doubt."
The old woman dabbed a smear of honey off her lips, gave Keza and Graza each a parting kiss upon the brow, and fastened her silken veil across her face.
"I shall return to the Temple of the Graces and pray for the gods to show my queen the course of wisdom."
When she was gone, Danny let Kezar fill her cup again, dismissed the children, and commanded that Hisdar Zolorek be admitted to her presence.
"And if he dare say one word about his precious fighting pits, I may have him thrown off the terrace."
Hisdar wore a plain green robe beneath a quilted vest. He bowed low when he entered, his face solemn.
"Have you no smile for me?" Danny asked him. "Am I as fearful as all that?"
"I always grow solemn in the presence of such beauty." It was a good start.
"Drink with me." Danny filled his cup herself. "You know why you're here. The Green Grace seems to feel that if I take you for my husband, all my woes will vanish."
"I would never make so bold a claim. Men are born to strive and suffer. Our woes only vanish when we die. I can be of help to you, however.
I have gold and friends and influence, and the blood of old Gis flows in my veins. Though I have never wed, I have two natural children, a boy and a girl, so I can give you heirs. I can reconcile the city to your rule and put an end to this nightly slaughter in the streets.
Can you?
Danny studied his eyes.
Why should the sons of the Harpy lay down their knives for you? Are you one of them?
No.
Would you tell me if you were?
He laughed. No.
The Shavepate has ways of finding the truth.
I do not doubt that Skahars would soon have me confessing. A day with him, and I will be one of the Harpy's sons. 2 days, and I will be the Harpy. 3, and it will turn out that I slew your father too, back in the Sunset Kingdoms when I was yet a boy.
Then he will impale me on a stake, and you can watch me die.
But afterward the killings will go on, his darling closer, or you can marry me and let me try to stop them.
Why would you want to help me? For the crown?
A crown would suit me well, I will not deny that. It is more than that, however. Is it so strange that I would want to protect my own people as you protect your freedmen? Merion cannot endure another war, your radiance. That was a good answer, and an honest one.
I have never wanted war. I defeated the Yunkai once, and spared their city when I might have sacked it. I refused to join King Cleon when he marched against them. Even now, with Astapor besieged, I stay my hand. And Karth? I have never done the Karthine any harm.
Not by intent, no, but Karth is a city of merchants, and they love the clink of silver coins, the gleam of yellow gold. When you smashed the slave trade, the blow was felt from Westeros to Ashai. Karth depends upon its slaves. So too Tolis, Nugis, Lys, Tyrosh, Volantis. The list is long, my queen.
Let them come. In me they shall find a sterner foe than Cleon. I would sooner perish fighting than return my children to bondage.
There may be another choice. The Yunkai can be persuaded to allow all your freedmen to remain free, I believe. If your worship will agree that the Yellow City may trade and train slaves unmolested from this day forth, no more blood need flow.
Save for the blood of those slaves that the Yunkai will trade and train,
Danny said, but she recognized the truth in his words even so.
It may be that is the best end we can hope for. You have not said you love me.
I will. If it would please your radiance.
That is not the answer of a man in love.
What is love? Desire? No man with all his parts could ever look on you and not desire you, Daenerys. That is not why I would marry you, however. Before you came, Meereen was dying. Our rulers were old men with withered cocks and crones whose pocket cunts were dry as dust. They sat atop their pyramids, sipping apricot wine and talking of the glories of the old empire whilst the centuries slipped by, and the very bricks of the city crumbled all round them. Custom and caution had an iron grip upon us, till you awakened us with fire and blood. A new time has come, and new things are possible. Marry me.
He is not hard to look at, Danny told herself, and he has a king's tongue. Kiss me, she commanded.
He took her hand again and kissed her fingers.
Not that way. Kiss me as if I were your wife.
Hisdar took her by the shoulders as tenderly as if she were a baby bird. Leaning forward, he pressed his lips to hers. His kiss was light and dry and quick. Danny felt no stirrings.
"Shall I, kiss you again?"
he asked, when it was over.
"No."
On her terrace, in her bathing pool, the little fish would nibble at her legs as she soaked. Even they kissed with more fervour than Hisdar Zolarak.
"I do not love you."
Hisdar shrugged.
That may come in time. It has been known to happen that way.
Not with us, she thought. Not whilst Dario so close. It's him I want, not you.
One day I will...